Hi, and welcome to New York, Quebec, and the water out to the center of the world. This is bonus episode 3, Colonial New York, Land of the Patroon and the Longhouse, Part 3. New York is a country that engages the spirit, summoning strange images. It is a land of near horizons, lifting high-angled screens between its folded valleys. Its days are full of clouds that drift over green summits and throw effervescent figures on tilted fields. Of sunny elms inexorably darkened by the march of shadow from straight-edged slopes. In these hollows, the Onondaga kept their sacred fires, interpreting to the Iroquois nations the message of the Creator and those of the warrior who found the paradise at the end of the right fork of the Milky Way. And when the Indians had been exiled by the white pioneers, they would raise their eyes to the earthen walls of their cleared lands and found spiritual release above them in these skyey reaches where men have often fancied the gods walked. And so it happens that in almost every lowland today, people tell the story of someone who saw visions few may see, heard voices meant only for appointed ears. The little winds that wander the labyrinth of New York State valleys sometimes bring with them, however, a sound that is not a voice. It is the beat of a drum. The roar of the cities overwhelms it, but there are a few upstate farmers who have not heard at some time or another that faraway tattoo. Among the Finger Lakes to the west, the sound is greater still, so loud in fact that it is sometimes mistaken for that of firearms. I have heard the professors of universities and colleges of the region speculate learningly on the causes that underlie the guns of Cayuga. But none have given an explanation any more reasonable than that offered by an old fisherman who said, "It's the sound of drums beneath the water." Perhaps Chief Jesse Cornplanter of the Seneca Nation was right when he told me, "The New York State drums are the death drums of my people." When the British fought the colonies, my forefather, Chief Cornplanter, was a friend of General Washington. But many of the tribe joined with the English armies in fighting against the white man, who had taken their land from them. And so, towards the end of the war, the American Congress sent a revenging army against the Seneca and the other Iroquois nations. They destroyed our villages. They burned our granaries filled with harvest. They killed our women and children. When they had gone, the Seneca who were left, starving and homeless, beat on their water drums and sang their death songs. Now the drummers are dead too. But sometimes they come back to the places where their villages were and beat their drums again and sing the death songs for the Senecas killed by the cruel white army." Carl Kramer, Listen for a Lonesome Drum. The year 1666 saw the largest European army in North America to date invade south from New France and devastate Iroquois. My own ancestor, Jean Poirier, served in the Chambly Company of the Carignan Regiment and participated in that Tracy expedition. Chastising the Mohawk and fortifying the Richelieu River against Iroquois incursions, this first group of professional French royal soldiers helped establish a new balance of power in the region. Assured of their triumph by peace negotiations, a year later the Jesuits visited the Mohawk capital at the modern-day village of Fort Plain. Dr. John Parmenter states, "The black-robed priests were given the normal welcoming in the shape of the Edge of the Woods ceremony, but with a mighty twist. Astonished at the rebuilt and refortified Mohawk castle, containing almost 1,000 inhabitants, the Jesuits were greeted with a show of polite but unmistakable military pageantry. Mohawk warriors lined the way to give salutes, and swivel cannon were fired from major dwellings. The message to the French was clear. The League understood that they were here to stay, but it would be the Iroquois who dictated from a position of strength. The League impressed its adversaries by quick population rebound due to the recent raiding and assimilation, but also through a new reorientation towards the St. Lawrence River in an effort to accommodate the recently assimilated peoples. The League had hit upon the wonderful idea of franchising its polity and culture towards the expansion of economic opportunities using the recently adopted members. The Jesuit presence assured a peace with New France, allowing prisoner exchanges, and opened up new Iroquois settlement opportunities closer to the heartland of New France. Kateri Tekakwitha was born right in the middle of this tempestuous period, sometime between 1662 and 1664. Her life encapsulates the Iroquoian wars of assimilation, as it was her mother who was captured at Trois-Rivières, brought as a slave to Iroquois, She married a league member and had two children. A set of paternal twins was born, and Kateri came into this world. It was quickly torn apart by the smallpox epidemics of the mid-century, set off by the Dutch. The disease carried away her parents and twin brother. Orphaned at the age of four and severely disfigured, she had barely degraded vision from the disease, so the young girl took to covering herself. Given to the care of an uncle, who was also a local sachem, marriage proposals did not come easy given her disfigured status. By 1667, Jesuit priests were lodged under the watch of Kateri's uncle, and this is where the young girl received her first contact with Catholicism. Peace negotiations that year between the Iroquois and French were strained by the League's interactions with the new English overlords. Jesuit priests thought they could entice the League away from their imperial English rivals, and the Iroquois saw a French presence in their village as guaranteeing safe movement throughout the region by tribal members. Any member harmed by French interests could be avenged by the easily accessible missionaries throughout Iroquois. Kateri started to frequent the village chapel, and her lodge didn't object, as long as she didn't leave for the missionary settlements near Montreal. Kateri's mother had apparently practiced Christianity, and her sister through adoption had already left for the native Christian village of Kanawak, or Sault Saint Louis. After a 1669 attack by the Mohegans were repulsed, many Mohawk warriors had led parties north to the relative safety of the Christian missions on the St. Lawrence by the start of the 1670s. Kateri's sister eventually sent her own husband to fetch Kateri in 1677 and bring her north to the missionary village where she could worship freely. Barely escaping her uncle, who was desperately attempting to stop the flow of villagers north, she made the arduous journey to her new home. Making her way up the Lac du Saint-Sacrement and Lac Champlain corridor to travel up the Richelieu River, she finally found her destination sitting near a series of rapids and opposite the island of Montreal. Kanawak was named after a former village in the Mohawk Valley of New York State, where many of the converts had come from. Engrossed in her new world, she took to a female community member who instructed her in the new faith. The rhythms of native existence played out amongst incredible scenes of Catholic devotion. Winter hunts were conducted between Christmas and Easter, with women accompanying the men of the village. Kateri experienced untrue accusations that she had become involved with a married man during the hunt, and she vowed never to return on one again. She now became devoted to bodily penance and began a life of earthly chastisement of her flesh. Gathering a small group of devoted women around her, she helped establish a future leading role for maternal Catholic education in Mohawk villages. Daily fasting and taxing carnal chastisement activities had left her weak and vulnerable to a cold caught in the early months of 1680. She died in April 17, 1680, after suffering from complications from a pneumonia-like condition. About a half an hour after her death, her smallpox-scarred face was said to change dramatically and became incredibly beautiful. This was followed by an overwhelming odor that was described as floral in origin. Her death during the holiest period of the Christian calendar would soon spark word of miracles. She made appearances to both the missionary priest and her band of female companions, as her burial site mementos started to produce stories of miracles widely circulating by the start of the 1700s. On June 22, 1980, her beatification took place in Rome and was presided over by Pope John Paul II. Her story still divides the Haudenosaunee peoples, as it did at the time of her death. The praying peoples of the St. Lawrence Valley would join the French for the first time against their non-Catholic brethren in a failed French expedition against the Seneca, just 3 years after the death of Kateri. The Catholic Mohawk would again join the French in a successful attack on Schenectady, New York in 1689, where traditional Mohawks started to burn captured Catholic converts for the first time. Her story marks a very fundamental and permanent development that would see the Five Nations become six, and witness Christian Iroquois fight for the French for more than 50 years later in a pivotal conflict that would decide control of the continent. While Kateri was well on her way to sainthood, the Confederacy was busy making peace with the Anishinaabe of the Peydon and opening up slaving raids of plain native peoples like the Fox by the 1670s. League advances against the Huron and other Algonquin-speaking peoples north of the Great Lakes caused French officials to make an ill-advised show of force. They sent a flotilla around Lake Ontario, but that only served to frighten New York colonial authorities. French officials started to trend towards fortifying the carrying places, so they could control the flow of animal pelts from the interior during this time period as well. The French were playing a game of cat and mouse with attempts to fortify the passage from Lake Ontario into the St. Lawrence. But this just caused the Iroquois to move their fur enterprise further north and west. Iroquois was on the move during the 1670s. A large flow of people going north to the praying villages was happening simultaneously as attacks into the Ohio River Valley and even to the outskirts of Boston occurred. By the start of King Philip's War in 1675, the League was perfectly placed to seize the initiative. A request for help in putting down the rebellion by New York colonial authorities had been met by the Eastern Guardians of the Longhouse in 1676. Hundreds of Mohawk warriors converged in Albany and crushed the New England Native Confederacy in conjunction with New York authorities. At the western door of the Longhouse, the Seneca were raiding Virginia and decimating Native populations in Pennsylvania, to the point of forced resettlement into Iroquois heartlands. Colonial governments in New England and to the south began to organize defeated natives into protected reservations in order to curb the Iroquois power. A peace covenant was reached in 1677 with the Iroquois releasing some captives but agreeing to no concrete limitation on their control of the North American interior. New York also established the position of Indian commissioner at this time to serve as the point person for relations with the League. Seneca war bands raided French-allied native Ohio River Valley tribes and moved into the Illinois country in greater numbers by 1680. Though the French sought to temper their offensive operations through shows of force at the eastern end of Lake Ontario, the League continued its campaign of elimination and assimilation of potential French allies in the Pays d'Enhaut. From 1682 to 1683, the League's military success began to further open the wounds between New France and the British colonies. Attacks against natives allied to the colony of Maryland, an intentional reduction of pelts sent to Albany to force price increases, saw British authorities viewing the Iroquois as instruments of the French and wholly lacking of their own agency. New York authorities made wild demands of the Mohawk and ordered them to dismantle their praying villages on the banks of the St. Lawrence. Mohawk leaders probably scoffed at these requests. They knew the true diplomatic and economic value of those of their house that adopted Catholicism. Assimilation and spatial movements had once again allowed the League to deftly operate a middle path between the two European powers and play them off against one another. Iroquois delegates even forced Pennsylvania to give up efforts to claim the Susquehanna River Valley through a legal deal with New York. League leaders transferred control of the region to New York instead. This was in exchange for free movement through it. This had prevented Pennsylvania from usurping Albany's fur trading role and allowed Iroquois war bands to access the Appalachian backwoods in order to raid for further captives. While the League attempted to run diplomatic circles around the British colonies, they focused on breaking the French threat in the Pays d'Enhaut, this by attacking Fort St. Louis in 1684. The fort's garrison only resisted over 200 Iroquois warriors with the help of local Shawnee and Illinois natives, though the French soon abandoned their position. Now the French had sought to punish the Iroquois through a military expedition against the Seneca, but mass sickness had them running to fortify Montreal by year's end. The League was well aware of the poor state of health that the French invasion force was in. This was due to intel provided by their Catholic native kinsmen. The Iroquois merely allowed the French to return home, chastised, defeated, and fearful of the League's next moves. The next year's fur trade was a true bounty, as Pax Iroquois prevailed throughout the fur trading lands. Now the League was exploiting the Niagara River portage and the Richelieu River route to circumvent French pelt exchange pathways. The League sought rapprochements in the Michilimackinac Straits and directed campaigns south against the Shawnee between 1685 to 1686, all while sealing closer economic ties to Albany. By 1687, the French king was determined to reset the balance of power and gain control over Lake Ontario, so French officials would launch an invasion of the lake environs by early summer. Iroquois diplomatic duplicity had led them to rely upon the English at Albany through their Mohawk contacts, but while still attacking southwest through the Seneca. Around 2,000 French soldiers, coureurs de bois, and native Christian allies participated in the raids. Hundreds of Iroquois prisoners were taken, with some being sent to staff the rowing galleys of the Sun King in the Mediterranean. While the enslaved suffered greatly, Seneca warriors fought a rearguard battle that greatly hampered the French efforts at destroying their forces. This was aided by information provided by Christian French allies, after they had witnessed the brutal treatment of their kinsfolk at the hands of the French invaders. While destroying much food and some important western castles, the French army couldn't bring the Iroquois to any definite engagement. They settled for a reinforcement of the passages around Lake Ontario and into the Pays d'Enhaut. Still, the Iroquois regrouped and laid siege to Fort Frontenac and harried French supplies throughout the following winter. During the first half of 1688, League members pursued retaliatory raids against the peoples of the Pays d'Enhaut for aiding the previous year's French attack on Iroquois. General diplomatic overtures were made to the English colonies, and the League was prepared to chastise New France in 1689 by striking deep into the St. Lawrence River Valley. In August, 1,500 Iroquois warriors landed at the southern tip of the island of Montreal and systematically burned Lachine and all the surrounding farmsteads they could find. They took several hundred captives and retreated after a week of powerful displays of their strength. The Iroquois attack happened to take place in front of a very malleable audience of Great Lakes and Midwest Native peoples who were near Montreal for the upcoming fur trade fair. A large amount of French capital was spent on establishing secure trade ties, and this was shattered in the eyes of the peoples of the Pays d'Enhaut. While Iroquois demonstrations of force had cowed the peoples of the Great Lakes region, French royal forces were determined to teach the Iroquois and their perceived English allies a lesson. In February of 1690, French forces successfully raided Schenectady, New York, and killed 50 out of the 250 total residents. Authorities in New England and New York collaborated in a combined naval assault against Quebec, and a land thrust against Montreal in the summer of 1690. The land advance petered out near the Catholic Mohawk settlements along the St. Lawrence, and the naval squadron was defeated by French forces. The year of 1691 saw a similar move to encircle New France, stemmed by the League's support for both sides. Warriors promised to another English expedition failed to materialize from western Iroquois tribes, and Mohawk allies warned their familial relations of upcoming attacks. The English assault against La Prairie turned into a mostly European affair, as natives on both sides found excuses to stay away. French forces guarding the town repulsed several hundred English, and this force had to fight its way back down the Richelieu River in August. Though connected by blood and marriage, the religiously divided Iroquois experienced heightened episodes of intercommunal violence, as European powers continued to squeeze their communities for greater commitments of alliance during this period. Mohawk warriors were actively encouraged to attack their Christian brethren and handed supplies to do so by Albany merchants. Their attack in September of 1692 was largely broken up by French resistance at Kahnawake. A retaliatory strike against the Mohawk Valley in the winter of 1693 saw the French hope to use a demonstration of force to firmly hold their tenuous alliance with Christian Iroquois together. Instead, the praying natives did all they could to slow down the progress of the expedition of 500 French, and they intentionally freed prisoners and refused to pursue any Iroquois kinfolk they came across. The League members rebuilt and expanded their castles along the Mohawk and reached out to the peoples of the Pays d'Enhaut. Dr. John Parmenter provides evidence in the exchange of condolence and calumet ceremonies. These shared rituals of communication and respect began to be enmeshed in the records by this period. By the start of 1694, peace initiatives had been proposed to both the English and French authorities by the League. This was especially pressing for the Mohawk. Peace talks with the French and Christian natives set up the framework for future widespread agreements across native and European frontiers. Europeans still viewed the Iroquois as a useful barrier, but the Haudenosaunee saw themselves as an axis upon which the entire region turned. English authorities had refused direct talks with the French, but Iroquois representatives backed them into a corner with news of their successful overtures. French efforts to undermine Iroquois diplomatic success in the Pays d'Enhaut paid off in 1695 when a large group of Wendat pounced upon a group of Iroquois scouts attempting to build an expedition fleet for movement on Lake Erie. Still, the French were rebuffed by these same natives later in the summer. The Wendat were insistent upon peace with the Iroquois, despite the efforts of some among them that sought closer partnership with the French. Fort Frontenac was reoccupied after being abandoned, and this caused the Mohawk to demand military action of Albany. The summer of 1696 saw simultaneous raids by the French against the Onondaga in the west, while the Mohawk warriors attacked Trois-Rivières. Despite not providing troops to defend their Iroquois allies, Albany authorities donated food and housing for the refugees of French raids to the west. A flurry of diplomatic activity was undertaken by the League in 1697. English authorities were told in no uncertain terms that they were unreliable and must demonstrate good faith. While this news was being delivered to Albany, League members were parleying directly at Fort Frontenac and then Montreal by the summer. French prospects and leverage had decreased when word of the Treaty of Ryswick had brought peace between England and France, ending King William's War. Royal French orders called for the removal of much of the French military presence from the Pays d'Enhaut, and this allowed Iroquois members free movement to fill the void. Prisoner exchange with New France and repatriation of questionable land grants to the English became Iroquois priority between 1698 to 1699. The culmination of this diplomacy and captive exchange were twin peace treaties with both English and French authorities in 1701. The French would be allowed to establish Detroit, and this would act as a site of conflict resolution and trade to bind the peoples of Iroquois, the Pays d'Enhaut, and the French Courier de Bois. In Albany, the League issued a deed to the English authorities, which was similar to a lease, and required English arms to maintain free movement through the northeast core interior of their homelands. The treaties above cemented the concept of Iroquois neutrality in the face of European conflict. This would be tested as New York authorities sought a fortified presence at Oswego, and competition turned south towards the Ohio River Valley. The Grand Settlement of 1701 was supposed to cement League neutrality and freedom of movement, but the increasing rise in European strength and the tempo of their external conflicts would put this work in danger. Queen Anne's War, or the War of Spanish Succession, coincided with the attempts to reap the benefits of this peace. It would be its first great test of this multinational framework of peace. The Confederacy started to strain under this pressure, and the beginning of the 18th century witnessed three factions appearing. Anglophiles, Francophiles, and the Neutral Party would split Iroquois for the next 50 years leading up to the French and Indian War. Christianized or praying natives would also be added to these three factions, further complicating the delicate balancing act the League wished to walk. The New Albany regime brought in by Queen Anne immediately disregarded the important diplomatic gestures of the condolence protocols and of gift-giving. The League turned to the French to keep the peace, and the price was the allowance of Jesuits into Iroquois settlements of upstate New York once again. French officials also led Abenaki and other eastern native-linked tribes against New England in 1703. This threatened to drown Iroquois neutrality in a sea of factionalism. New England could have requested aid from New York and hence dragged the Anglophile League members into battle against their French-aligned brethren or close trading partners to the north. It is at the start of the 18th century that we see the development of commissioners of tribal affairs and grand treaty gatherings. These sometimes formal and sometimes subleased diplomatic and economic exchange routes relied upon Europeans, usually captured by Iroquois peoples and later released. The position would then shift towards men who lived syncretic lives on the frontier between native and European peoples. The British would especially come to rely upon the Dutch of the Hudson Valley and those acculturated into their uniquely insular networks with native peoples. Manorial lands would be in need of expansion, and land agents rose to occupy diplomatic posts due to their experience shuffling between these two worlds. In the first decade of the 18th century, a Dutch New Yorker by the name of Lawrence Clausen and a Frenchman by the name of Jean Kerr came to act as point men for European relations and trade negotiations. Both had earlier been made captive, Clausen in Canada and Jean Kerr with the League in the Mohawk Valley. The Iroquois pursued individual peace agreements and trade relations with the Miami and Ottawa. By 1708, this had made a huge impact on the fur trade reaching Montreal. Now much of the Pays d'Enhaut and Ohio River Valley furs were appearing in Albany. Even some Courier de Bois were convinced to act as interlopers for the English cause. An assassination of a major English-allied French trader and French insistence on moving the League capital to Seneca country led to a swing back towards British influence amongst the League. The manorial Schuyler family is mentioned playing a major diplomatic role in an effort to expel French priests and traders, while receiving League support for a British campaign up the Champlain Valley corridor into New France. When this failed to materialize, Peter Schuyler even accompanied several Iroquois to London in 1710 on a public relations mission to cement royal court support for the renewed alliance with the League. Anglican missionaries would be sent to the Mohawk Valley, and British fortifications were allowed to be constructed. French efforts to fortify Onondagan territory in 1711 were quashed by Iroquois invitation to Peter Schuyler and a small force from Albany. The Iroquois again joined British efforts to attack Canada in 1711, but the naval component foundered on the attempted entry up the St. Lawrence River. These military failures and Albany merchants purposely driving the price of firearms and powder through the roof caused a shift in league posture by 1712. Schuyler and Clausen were sent out with the appropriate war goods and promises to quickly deliver the fortifications promised for the Mohawk Valley. The Mohawk village of Ticonderoga was fortified first, and a proper chapel was constructed for the growing Protestant community. By 1716, more than one-third of the almost 400 residents attended church, though a smallpox epidemic soon saw many return to the previous pagan practices. While frustrating Anglican missionaries, the Mohawk especially had assimilated and built upon their ties with the Dutch Reformed Church, in order to tie themselves culturally to the European power closest to them in Albany. The Anglican Church was surprised when missionary work resumed a decade later, and a core corpus of religious knowledge was still quite evident. The Mohawk took their role as the Eastern doorkeepers very seriously, and viewed these religious ties as another tool in the geopolitical repertoire. The 1713 treaty that ended hostilities between the British and French in the War of Spanish Succession, or Queen Anne's War as it was called in North America, marked League members down as subjects of the British Crown. But it had little relation to the reality on the ground. The neutral party had begun to be seen as the most wise and common sense approach for the League, attempting to balance the continued competition between France and Britain. To maintain this balance and peace in the Northeast, Iroquois members sought French support in the West to raid the hinterlands of the Carolinas. The French at Detroit were delighted to provide weapons, and the Iroquois balanced this French goodwill to weaken British efforts in the South. Major migrations of Iroquoian-speaking peoples like the Tuscaroras strengthened the League and reoriented its focus southeast against Anglo settlement pushing into the Ohio River Valley and further west. The League learned to not only play off European rivals, but also individual British colonies. Their involvement in southern colonial wars and the placement of newly acquired native allies along the western expanses from Virginia to Pennsylvania forced many colonial states to negotiate directly with the League. After 1722, Pennsylvania elevated the League as representatives of or overlords of the colony's native population. This gave the neutral party further tools to manipulate intra-colonial disputes. Colonial competition to fortify the water routes in upstate New York increased dramatically with the French fort built at Niagara in 1726 and the British fort at Oswego in 1727. Now traders and soldiers from both Montreal and Albany had repositioned themselves deep into Iroquois and began to cut the League out of its valuable position as middlemen of the fur trade. The neutral party negotiated trading rights at both new European forts and hoped they could continue to balance the powers off against each other. League members changed their pattern of settlement by the 1730s with smaller towns and single-family cabins that resembled European frontier homes. Many had moved south and north in an attempt to circumvent European establishments in the heart of Iroquois. This resulted in further mixed communities in Canada and now in the Ohio River Valley. Illegal land acquisition that occurred in the eastern Mohawk country was also becoming evident in the western parts of Iroquois by the 1730s. New York's great manorial estates had begun to fill in the lower Hudson Valley, and settlers flowed into League territory in the Mohawk Valley. Germans, Irish, and African slaves now added to the tempestuous mix of Iroquois, Dutch, and French that had previously marked the groups vying for control of the region. Sir William Johnson would rise from among this group of immigrants and played a vital local role in maintaining the balance of power as New York's head of Indian affairs. While I outlined Johnson's biography in an earlier episode, his blood and commercial ties to the Mohawk were instrumental when peace was finally broken between the British and French in 1744. King George's War saw much of the League pursue neutrality, but the Mohawk used this opportunity to publicize their grievances against New York's illegal land deals in exchange for providing war parties to attack the French. Little came of the war militarily for the Mohawk, and the British again failed to move their forces against Canada. So competition shifted towards the Ohio River Valley after war's end. While neutrality reigned throughout much of the Mohawk Valley, the new Iroquois link communities of the Ohio River Valley were becoming increasingly anti-French and supported by Pennsylvania and Virginia. Albany had seen a severe downturn in relations with the Mohawk, and the Seneca in the far west had begun to move towards French missionary villages nearer to Canada once again. A 1749 French mission into the Ohio River Valley claimed important geographic features for the French crown. And not soon after, the Mohawk would declare their covenant chain broken with the British in Albany. Desperate to calm the turbulent waters, a massive North American colonial-wide effort was convened in 1754 at Albany to discuss native diplomacy. Mohawk representatives chastised New York for its illegal land deals and economic stranglehold on Iroquois life. They also demanded the reinstatement of William Johnson. Johnson had resigned after the last war due to infighting with the Albany Indian Commission. Now the Mohawk insisted that his reinstatement would be the price of their renewed covenant. Still, behind closed doors, Iroquois leaders cut land deals with Pennsylvania. Though Johnson had managed to recruit several hundred Mohawk, neutrality still prevailed among the Iroquois after Braddock's defeat at the Wilderness in 1755. The Seven Years' War would see Iroquois neutrality sapped by overwhelming British victories by 1759, when Johnson was finally able to convince the Western League members to join in the war. When the war ended with a British victory, no longer could the League play off major European powers, but now their extended longhouse was united under British rule. The Iroquois League would survive the war intact, but would now find itself ever more reliant on a British polity that was about to tear itself apart in its own brutal civil war just over a decade later. Thank you for listening to New York, Quebec, and the Water Route to the Center of the World. And don't forget to catch me at the upcoming History Camp in Boston this August.